Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and the topic of today's show is, to me, very timely. That topic is gambling in the United States. Just today, as I was listening to a sports talk radio show this morning while exercising, I heard wall-to-wall ads during a commercial break for sportsbook companies. You can't go to a restaurant or a bar or a golf course, as I do quite a bit, without seeing gambling machines, lotto, slots, everywhere. This seems to be one thing that unites blue state Illinois and red state Iowa in our listening area, the proliferation of gambling. I can't help but think this is not good for our country, and I hate to sound like a scold, but it's just everywhere, and I'm very concerned, and that's why today's show is so timely, because of a book written by my guest. It's called Losing Big. He's Jonathan Cohen. It's called Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling, and I found this book very, very important and very concerning for our future. And John, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me. And I promise, I think the conversation might be worrying, but I hope it can also be, let's say, entertaining. And I think, let's say, not turn people off from watching sports entirely, even if it turns them off from the gambling side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge sports fan. And I think it's okay to feel concerned about this because I see it every day. I go back in Illinois. I was in the legislature. They passed riverboat gambling. It was heavily regulated. They passed the lotto to help schools. It seemed to start on a very limited basis. But what was it that really opened up the floodgates?
It's actually the same thing that opened up the floodgates in Illinois for gambling writ large is what opens up in across the entire country for sports betting. And really, it just comes down to money. Gambling has long been seen in this country, going back to the 18th century, the 17th century even, as a tax-free source of revenue for government. And it's just, if people don't like paying taxes, government needs to fund stuff. Lo and behold, there's sort of always more money in the gambling cookie jar. And so that is the primary driver for states to get in on the gambling business. And then sort of more specifically and more to the point, in 2018 was a Supreme Court decision that overturned a law that was preventing states from legalizing sports gambling. So Illinois, Iowa may have wanted to legalize sports gambling along with riverboat casinos, along with lottery, going back to the 70s and 80s, where they were barred from doing so until the Supreme Court opened the floodgates in 2018.
It's all about money. How big is gambling right now, John? I mean, I'm just curious, the economic impact, I guess, overall.
Yeah, gambling is a huge industry, and then sports gambling in particular. I think Americans are either about to or have just passed the $500 billion mark of legal sports bets since 2018.
And I'm not a scold. I go play lottery every week. I mean, I used to go, I'll go play a little, games a little bit, but this has really got big, obviously. It's everywhere. What's the impact of this? I guess we're starting to see patterns of some negative impacts. Where is it located, targeted in our country right now?
Yeah. So I'll say even before all of this started, the sort of recent wave, right, as you'll probably already know, right, there were some Americans, roughly 1% of adults, who were already getting addicted to gambling, even with sort of the operations that we had. You know, these were people who would be spending weeks or months at a casino. You know, imagine the little old lady at the slot machine. So we already sort of had a plenty of gambling addiction, going back for multiple decades. And now we've put it onto people's cell phones in 30, soon to be 31 states later this year when it arrives in Missouri. And so we don't have the sort of the raw data yet on sort of rates of gambling addiction. But indications are that, even again, putting addiction aside, let's talk about gambling harm sort of writ large, that is increasing. You know, we've increased the number of people who gamble by so much. You know, 50% of American adults between, excuse me, 50% of American men between the ages of 18 and 49 have a sports gambling account. So even if only 1% of that group is running into trouble, you're talking about 50% of, you're talking about 1% of half of all American adults. So, you know, 100 men, half 175 million people. So that being said, so it's going to affect a lot of people. It's going to cause harm to a lot of people in a lot of ways. But if we're just to provide finally, after bearing the lead, a short answer to your question, it is the harms are disproportionately concentrated among young men who are the ones who are getting into trouble, who are gambling more than they can afford, or who are developing addictions.
You go into detail with a couple people you met along the way that's that illustrate this, but what is it about young men, I guess, that makes them I mean, who find gambling so appealing?
Okay, so I have three answers, and I should say that I'm 34, so I don't know if I qualify anymore as a young man, but as a, you know, formerly young man.
Close enough.
Yeah, close enough. Okay, so I have three sort of speculative answers, sort of rooted in my conversations, both with the men I cover in the book and then sort of other conversations I've had. So the first is, I would say, young men in general are not exactly known for being particularly judicious and wise and careful. And this is actually a universal phenomenon that's cross-cultural. It's not just in the United States. So they're sort of already predisposed to risk and in many cases to gambling. So, okay, you could see how that would sort of parlay itself, pun intended, into all of a sudden they have legal gambling on their phone and why that would take it off. And then you, of course, have the disposition among young men towards sports and sports fandom, not to mention, let's call it a, and this is being kind, an overconfidence. And I say this as someone, as again, a formerly young male sports fan who was certainly overconfident in my knowledge of sports and wanting to prove that I knew sports better than my friends or other people. And you know, fantasy football, this it's rooted in this desire to show your friends that you know sports better than they do. And then there's this final factor that's a little bit iffier or a little bit sort of looser, but I think, and this I saw this in my work on the lottery too, is you see a sense among young men today that it's sort of what Kyla Scanlon calls financial nihilism, where you know maybe they have some savings, maybe they even have discretionary income, but it's not so much that they feel they can buy a house or start a business or pay off their student loan. Whether or not this is true, they sort of feel that the American dream, that the ladder has sort of been pulled up and the rug's pulled out from under them. And so what's the point of having $10,000 in your savings account when you could risk that $10,000 with a chance of $1 million or $100,000? So you sort of, you see why this would translate really well, not just to sports gambling, but even to cryptocurrency, to stock trading and other sort of risky financial behavior that, again, these young men with undeveloped prefrontal cortices are already predisposed to biologically and culturally.
Fascinating too, because I just read a Wall Street Journal poll this morning, the morning here we're taping this show. 70% of the American public no longer believes the American dream is attainable, which is frightening and really unfortunate for our country. Is the typical person younger and male? Okay, how does it play out as far as their finances? Is this are that do they have lower incomes, higher incomes, college degrees, not, or is do you have data on that?
Yeah. So I would say, so some of the data we have indicates that it is actually pretty universal. And I'm comparing to something like the lottery, which is really disproportionately concentrated among also male, but lower income, non-white communities. And sports betting, you see it really across the board. And in fact, one of the studies on the sort of the causal effects of sports betting finds specifically a reduced investment and reduced savings in low-income households when sports betting arrives in a state. Sports betting is sort of weird compared to the lottery because it really is a matter of you can get out of it what you put into it, and there's sort of a bottomless well of things to bet on, and you could bet $2 on the Bears, and I could bet $200, and we're betting on the same thing. We have the same sort of rooting interest, but as far as I can tell, this is a sports fandom is universal or pretty universal, and sports gambling has become basically just as universal.
I was amazed to see in your book, and I think I had read this before, but gambling has gone so far. I mean, it used to be you would bet on a team winning or losing. And I've noticed too, as you point out in the book, that that everybody, it's open now. They're talking about betting lines where that used to be kind of kept back. But Now they're betting on like whether the next pitch is going to be a strike, and that to me anyway. Again, I hate to sound like a scold for all the younger people out there. Call me an old fart or whatever you want to do, but that just seems like it's going too far.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. I also don't want to sound like a scold, but let's take the sports gambling companies at their word, right? The FanDuel, which is the largest sports betting company in the U.S. by market share, its motto is "Make every moment more." Right? Okay, fine. The implication being you want to make sports even more exciting. Parentheses. The implication is that sports is boring if you don't gamble on it. But okay, that you want to increase your excitement with sports by gambling on it. Okay, fine. I'm not sure who's getting more excitement from sports when you can bet, as I did last week, just because I could, on who's going to win the fourth point in the third match of a Czech table tennis tournament. Like, who's watching a Czech table tennis tournament and saying, "Oh man, I really want to sort of up the ante on this game." Those kinds of bets, or even the speed of the next pitch, the outcome of the next tennis serve, those are just trapdoors for people with problem gambling. So again, I think sports gambling should be legal, and I'm interested in, and I'm okay with some of these sort of innovations that have been brought to the betting market. But there's a clear sort of know it when you see it phenomenon of, okay, this is a normal, fun way to augment someone's experience. You can bet on the White Sox to win. Maybe you can even bet on who's going to hit the first home run or whatever the case may be. But betting on a point in a Czech table tennis tournament, that's nothing but providing an outlet for someone with gambling addiction who's going to chase action wherever they can find it.
I read one of your examples was a person who was trying to break himself of this and wound up betting on tennis. Wasn't it overseas or something?
Tennis is so popular for this, for exactly that reason. It happens at all times of, there's some Malaysian tennis tournament happening right now at 11 o'clock in the morning, you know? And it's, you can bet on individuals, you can bet on points. Someone who's addicted to gambling isn't addicted to sports. They're not addicted to money. They're not addicted to winning. They're addicted to action. They're addicted to the moments of uncertainty, the dopamine. So they'll bet on tennis just because they can, just because it's something for them to bet on, and that's what they're looking for. Well, you're a huge Malaysian tennis fan, so I don't need to tell you.
That's right. I just placed a couple bets this morning. Just kidding, listeners. You're listening to Heartland Politics here on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is Robin Johnson back for a very interesting interview with Jonathan Cohen, who's the author of Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. And it's a very enlightening book. I recommend you get it and read it because my sense is this is coming to a head, and there's going to be some headlines, some problems in this. And I don't think it's too. I've got a note here saying it's a disaster waiting to happen, and I don't want to be too melodramatic, but I just have a feeling this isn't going to end well. It's not ending well for some people, as John outlines in his book, and he also looks at some of the targeted audience of this. I remember I served as a staff person in the Illinois legislature in 1987 when riverboat gambling was legalized, and it was heavily regulated. You could only lose so much. They actually, and believe it or not, the riverboats had to leave and go on a cruise for 2 hours. They did not have ATM machines. There was limits all over the place, and I even remember I played the slots, and you had the actual handles. Now you just press a button, but all those regulations, the opponents warned that once you got a foot in the door, all those regulations would go away, and that's exactly what's happened. Is John, is what happened here was the rush of governments to get this money so great that they did not properly regulate this? Is that fair?
Yeah, so all of this started right with sort of a crusade in New Jersey back in the early 2000s, or the early 2010s, and I think, to your point, Chris Christie, who was the governor at the time who got this started, I think if you sort of injected him with the truth serum and said, "Hey, when you sort of started this crusade, were you hoping to bet on like the Jets and the Giants, or were you hoping to bet on Malaysian women's doubles badminton at 3 in the morning?" I think he probably was expecting the former. It's sort of the version of this heavily regulated riverboat gambling, let's say, that was enacted in Illinois in 1987. And so, but once it arrived, first of all, cell phone technology had sort of taken off by the time the Supreme Court decision came out in 2018, and these companies sort of got their foot in, they got more than their foot in the door. They got their sort of talons into the legislators and into the lawmakers and into the regulators, and wrote And as I report about the state of Colorado specifically, they sort of held the pen in many cases on the legislation to shape the regulation such that it wasn't not only were we going to launch online right away, but we were going to launch online sort of in a full-throated way where you can lose multiple mortgage payments in a matter of a few seconds. So I think, yes, the promise of money for states is sort of at the root of all of this and was sort of dangled, but I don't want to blame states and let lawmakers entirely. I think they got hoodwinked a little bit as to what exactly this product was going to entail by these self-interested corporate actors.
You have, I mean, I remember in Illinois too. The reason they enacted the lottery was they said that that money would go to education, and of course, it was a shell game. Education funding was not increased; they just moved money over, and it was a big shell game. And it's too bad. They wonder why people don't trust institutions. That's part of the reason, going back to that. But I mean, how much money are governments making off this? I mean, does it make it kind of worthwhile in the end, or is it just like governments have become addicted to this?
So worthwhile is an interesting word and interesting question because on paper, governments are making plenty of money, a couple $100 million here or there or more in some cases, which is, of course, a drop in the bucket, as you well know, of the state's sort of overall income and overall expenditure. But then there's this sort of flip side question that hasn't been answered yet as to at what cost, right? If you look at, Maryland, which I think took in $154 million in gross revenue, tax revenue for the state. That's great. I'll take $154 million in tax revenue. But what about the increase in bankruptcies that are documented from sports gambling? The rise in domestic violence, which is also a documented phenomenon. The reduced savings that is going to lead to increased uses of social safety net programs, and so on. So I think it looks good on paper, and of course, every legislator is just looking to get through the next election, the next year, the next budget. But I think over the long term, I wonder if, pun intended, this isn't sort of a losing game, even for government.
Yeah, I wonder too. I can't help but wonder too. And this goes back to, you talk about the people that this is impacting most, the profile, as you talk about in your book and here today, younger males, and this goes across race and ethnicity. It's young Hispanics, young blacks, young whites. And I just wonder, because these are the groups politically that I've had guests on my show in recent weeks talking about the big shift going on, that younger male voters shifted over to Donald Trump in the last election. And I know this is kind of a maybe offbeat question, but is there any connection here between maybe they're liking a guy like Donald Trump more and their affinity for gambling, especially the online gambling, with their phones and all that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should be surprised just to our conversation about the American dream that people who feel frustrated with the state of the American dream are drawn to someone who, by their own admission, wants to sort of burn everything down and start it over and sort of reset the American institutions. And whether you like him or not, that's sort of what cl Trump clearly represents and has represented. And there's something, and also, people who are not fans of his might like this joke that he sort of ran a casino into the ground, but he really was sort of identified with the sort of gambling mentality and gambling mindset and biz and money making mentality and a business mindset that I think, again, in a time of financial precarity, in a time when the economy is not providing opportunity, I don't think we should be surprised that people would sort of take a long shot bet on a political candidate in the way that they're making a long shot bet on, a Thursday night's Bears game or whatever the case may be.
Monday night,
Bears
Monday night
fight,
games.
yes.
I thought one of the interesting parts of the book was how the advertising of these sportsbook companies, once this was legalized by the Supreme Court in 2018, I believe it was, this is what really opened up the floodgates. But they had a lot of African American celebrities. They had the Mannings on. They had a lot of prominent people. That really, I mean, very smart marketing by these sportsbook companies to get people involved. And that's basically an oligarchy, like a lot of other segments of our economy, it seems like. I mean, how did that get to be where there was just a few companies that were dominated the market?
Yeah, I mean, so if folks, know that the casino world is not sort of concentrated in that way, right? If you go to Las Vegas, there's many different casinos. Some of them are owned by the same companies, but there are a couple of different options. But the sports betting world is really effectively a duopoly, right? It's effectively two companies, FanDuel and DraftKings, that dominate the space and until relatively recently had, around 80% of the total market share. And they were the fastest movers to online, to our conversations earlier. They were sort of ready for it. And they were, as you may remember from about 10 years ago, the pioneers of daily fantasy sports, which was officially not gambling, but of course, de facto gambling. And through that process, they developed name recognition and sort of trust with customers, specifically among these sort of young men, who this is again because they were effectively offering you a way to gamble on football without officially offering you a way to gamble on football, that they were jumped out right ahead. And they did much of that marketing that you said, where they were sort of the most aggressive, and that's sort of been their track record now for a decade. And yeah, and they're reaping the rewards accordingly for their market dominance.
NFL season starts Thursday night, and perhaps the most interesting chapter in your book was how the NFL at first was for keeping its distance from this phenomenon, but kind of gradually came along because of the dollars. Can you give a brief summary of that?
Yeah, I mean, this is before my time, but the NFL has a decades-long history of being virulently anti-gambling, in sort of dramatically so, right? They sort of wanted to make they wanted to be so anti-gambling as to make a point of it. For example, threatening or actually, in fact, suspending Joe Namath in 1969, not because he was gambling, but because he co-owned a bar that was known as a gathering spot for people who did gamble. And that was enough for the NFL to sort of keep one of their star quarterbacks at the time away from the sport. He eventually sold his stake in the bar, which let him rejoin the league in 1969. But okay, but and it's been the punching bag for the NFL for a long time. In the height of the concussion crisis, Roger Goodell says that gambling is the number one threat to the integrity of football, and they're punching down to gambling over and over again. And then lo and behold, May 14th, 2018, when the Supreme Court decision comes around, was sort of basically the start of a 2-year process through which the NFL completely pivoted and went from saying that gambling is a threat to its product to saying that legal gambling embraced by the league is the safest way to or the best way to ensure that gambling does not threaten the integrity of football, because now it can be monitored. And of course, now, as you've alluded to, the league and the sports league and the teams can make money from partnerships and from data sales and from advertising, from the new gambling economy.
We've already had a couple instances of, I believe, those NBA player or two that were caught in some type of gambling infraction. And what are some that we've had here so far? And again, I'm concerned that we're going to have a bigger story down the line. But what are the ones that have happened so far
Yeah.
that you can share?
I mean, there have been a couple, including down at Iowa State. I think it was the baseball team that all got into trouble. And so a couple at the collegiate level, mostly at smaller schools, mostly in basketball. And then the big story that sort of broke headlines a year or two ago was Jontay Porter, who's this sort of very, very minor NBA player who was gambling on himself to lose or to go under a certain number of points, rebounds, and so on. And basically was found out to have a gambling problem himself and was trying to pay off some debts, it seems like, to some bookies or some nefarious actors. What's interesting to me about this is, okay, on the one hand, the leagues say, okay, this is proof that a system is working, right? This is someone who we might not have caught otherwise, but for the fact that gambling is now above board, it's regulated, it's taxed, and it's visible. The flip side, of course, is all you've actually done is raised the profile of gambling so much that people who never would have thought about gambling potentially are now going to do it. And all these basketball players at Sacramento State or whatever who are gambling on themselves probably would not have done that otherwise, but for the fact that now gambling is sort of in the sports bloodstream. And also the leagues were doing a plenty good job of monitoring it before, which is how we get, the Black Sox scandal and Pete Rose and all these other things that were, of course, surfaced because the leagues had mechanisms in place to monitor illegal gambling. So yes, I do not think we should be surprised that this is becoming more common. The really worrying one for me is, let's say a long snapper on a college football team takes a bribe or something, which you can't guarantee, but there's a chance that the long snapper on a field goal could swing the entire game with a bad snap. And there's no way that you could never know if someone's betting on, a football, the Iowa money line, the team to win. And I just don't know what you could possibly do about that. And I don't think the leagues have either. And I think they should have thought of this before they jumped headfirst into sports gambling.
Boy, with football coming up, I won't look at long snaps the same way or any kind of snaps during this season.
And this was the fear. This was the fear of the sports leagues when they first cracked down, was that people would interpret routine player and referee error as not innocent and part of sports, which of course it is, but as nefarious and as a result of rigging and as, another reason to distrust the integrity of sports. But of course it happens all the time. But now people are primed to think, oh, that long snapper, they didn't just cost my team, they also cost me $100,000 or whatever the case may be. And I don't know if that bodes well for the future, actually, of American sports and American sports fandom.
As we wrap up here, I just want to emphasize one point you just made for our listeners who think we're a couple of older scolds. Well, you're not old, but I am. Your contention is, and you show in the book that what the concern is that this is bringing in all this added gambling is bringing in people who wouldn't otherwise have done it. That's the concern, and I get it. This isn't going anywhere. You say this in the book. The Supreme Court legalized it. All the people who said, well, the people would be doing this illegally otherwise, blah, blah, blah. So this isn't going anywhere. But you do add a section in the back of the book where you talk about some reforms. You give quite a few. We've got about, a couple minutes here, John. What are the most important reforms you think that need to be made to kind of rein in gambling?
Yeah, it actually all comes down to a single word, and this was you sort of tacitly alluded to this in your point about the riverboat regulation. Is I think what you need is friction. What you need is the equivalent of not putting an ATM on the riverboat, or the equivalent of a lever instead of a button, right? You need something to slow down the process such that, for example, you can only deposit a certain number of into your account a certain number of times in a 24-hour period, or you have to prove that you can afford your $100,000 deposit, or whatever the case may be, or the apps just shouldn't let you bet on check table tennis. Of course, that's going to hurt my bottom line, but I'll survive. Something to slow down the process by which someone can begin by innocently placing a few $5 bets, and that sort of becomes the process by which they start snowballing into addiction. They chase their losses, they get mad, they chase more losses. All of a sudden, they've gone from betting 500 from $5 to 500 to 5,000. And so on. And then your dopamine pathways get rewired in your brain and you're addicted and you actually can't stop and you're not choosing to gamble anymore. So friction, anything to slow down the process. I've just listed a few examples and but there are plenty of others that states could enact or that Congress could enact for them that would keep gambling legal, as I think it should be. And I think gambling can and should be fun. But we've made it too easy for someone to go from having fun gambling to not fun and running into trouble.
And I'm Exhibit A. I'll just add real quick. I used to play the old slots where you pulled it, and then with the buttons. I remember I would go into the riverboats, take $100 when I lost it. That was it. I'd go watch TV sports, but boy, it got quick losing $100 when you just pressed a button. But anyway, that illustrates the point. Jonathan Cohen's been my guest today. He's the author of an important book it's called "Losing Big: America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling." Take a look at it, folks. I think it's an emerging issue that is going to be with us, and I hope that it can be changes can be made before we get a really big scandal in one of our major sports. John, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thanks, and good luck to the Bears on Monday.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.